It's a delight to welcome you to this amazing, incredible and iconic space. I think it always gives me a great thrill just to be here. So, my friends and colleagues, the theme of this spring's series of lectures is hope, not an easy issue to deal with. However, I think you might all agree we have never been more in need of hope, whether it be for global peace, for the environment, for perhaps our personal aspirations, and even perhaps for our personal despair. So the question is, what is hope, other than fantasy and daydreaming? What is realistic, constructive hope? What does it look like, and how do we encourage and access it? How do we demonstrate hope in public life? This is the first conversation on the theme of hope. We have faith, and I assume we all have a modicum of charity, so it's the hope's turn. We are extremely fortunate to launch this series with Dame Barbara Slocking, the president of Murray Edwards College, formerly Newhall, and the former chief executive of Oxfam. Dame Barbara has a distinguished record as a public servant. She spent several years in West Africa working for the World Health Organization before being appointed director of the King's Fund. This was followed by the post of chief executive of the Oxfordshire Regional Health Authority, and before joining Oxfam, she became the director of the National Health Service Modernisation Agency, which was tasked with rolling out NHS reforms. Not easy. During her time at Oxfam, Barbara built many valuable relationships with private organisations and raised significant funds. She herself was interested in campaigning for land rights for small landholders and for nomadic peoples. So Dame Barbara's lecture is entitled Hope in Society, and let us give her a warm welcome.
Well, thank you so much for that very warm welcome, and it is a great privilege to be here tonight. And I've been saying to people, this is probably one of the most difficult talks I've ever given. It is quite a tricky question, this. But the way I'm going to go about it is to, first of all, say why I think hope is very important to us as human beings, and what happens when we don't have it, and how hope can be found in some of the most unlikely of places. I'll also, in the sort of first half, talk about why I'm optimistic about hope and where I get that optimism from. And then I'll come on to the difficult part, which is, even if you have hope, this is definitely a moment when the global challenges that we have seem absolutely enormous and intractable. And I want to talk about whether there are channels in the ways we can place our hope to make something happen, to bring about the changes we want. So it's sort of two halves, really. Obviously, my examples come a lot from my 12 years as experience as chief exec of Oxfam, but more recently in Cambridge, I have around me, well, it's a women's college, so I have a lot of young women, but I also have quite a lot of young men that I meet in various ways. And a lot of what I'm going to say is about what young people today I hear. And also, because I'm doing some work on young people and work in developing countries, I'm meeting a lot of young people there too. And so it's all those examples I'm going to try and use to make some of the case. So I'm going to start with the definition of hope, the usual Oxford English Dictionary. It says, to want something to happen, or to be true. That's the hope part of it. And to think that this could happen or be true. In other words, it's not just the thing itself, it's the idea that actually things could happen through that hope. It's not just vain, you know, hope that's not going to happen. It is hope about something can happen. So starting with the first thing about what happens when you don't have hope. In Angola in 2002, the war was ending, and people who had lived in the bush for years and years were coming down and coming into camps that Oxfam was working in. They would obviously go back either to their own communities or to new sites eventually. And I was there visiting, and I saw a middle-aged man, and I looked into his eyes, and they were completely and utterly blank. And I thought he was ill, and I said to the staff that I was with, you know, is he ill? And they said, no, he's not physically ill. But what's happened to him is he's completely lost hope. And interestingly, 3 or 4 days later, the staff said to me, and he has now died. You simply cannot live without hope. If hope is gone, you know, that's it. But then, much more positively, I've seen people in the most distressing situations, living in shanty towns in corrugated iron and cardboard and sheeting, or in villages where droughts and floods have happened and their livelihoods have gone. And yet, surprisingly, these people had hope. An example I'll give you is at the height of HIV and AIDS transmission in Africa, when there were no antiretrovirals for the people, I spent a day in a women's project in Zimbabwe. Oxfam was supporting it, and it's relevant that it was women then, because women, the transmission to women was actually at its absolute peak at that point. What was happening in the project was that it was providing economic opportunity to the women so that they and their children could afford food, because good nutrition with a disease like that is very important. But it was also providing more knowledge about HIV and about sexual protection. Now, all this was done through song and dance and role play. The women thought the role play was absolutely hilarious, and they laughed and they sang, and that was hope. And that's why, for me, it was such a privilege to work with Oxfam, because we worked on the grounds in the most difficult circumstances, and of course we couldn't solve it all. There was no question that we could only make a small inroad into it. But what we could do was give people enough hope. And that's what they said. We gave them the hope that gave them the energy to do more and to have confidence that they could change some things themselves. So that's a bit about hope. But why am I optimistic about hope and the future? In Oxfam, I was surrounded by people who felt that the world could be a better place. Now, they weren't naive, nor was it random individuals and action, but it was obviously based on programmes of work, whether it was emergency relief, long-term development, or campaigning for change in policies, because those are the real determinants of poverty, both globally and locally. And I will come back, actually, to some of the idea of about planned concerted activity, but, you know, towards the end of what I'm talking about. But during that time, my hope did come from the poorest people. Because of, despite those circumstances, I've said, they did work to try to make things better for themselves and their communities. And I was hugely privileged to sit and talk with them, just as one human being to another, really. Now, more, my energy comes from being with young people. Where I am, of course, I'm with some of the most outstanding young people in the country. And I have to say, in my college, 67 to 70% of all the students come from state schools in the undergraduate level. But what they have is confidence and the hope to aspire. And what we're trying to do in the work we're doing is, of course, trying to give them the skills to really turn those dreams, those hopes into realities. But more recently, as I said, I've been involved with young people in developing countries. And I'd just like to explain this a moment. In the next 10 years, it's estimated that 1 billion young people will come onto the jobs market. 9/10 in developing countries, completely different from us in the UK, where we're, you know, we're an ageing population. It's also estimated by the World Bank that only, at best, 400 million jobs will be created. That actually leaves 600 million young people without jobs. So how are they going to survive? Well, probably in the way that so many of them are doing now, and it's called getting by. That's how young people talk about it all the time now. It's a mixture, not of a job, but of paid and unpaid work, formal sector, informal, often across family and the wider community. These young people will not have jobs as we know them in this country, not even for short-term periods. Yet the ones I meet are enormously hopeful. They have energy, enthusiasm, and a real, real drive to take care of themselves and make a contribution in their own societies. So we have, I believe, a responsibility to support, find ways to support them. Because apart from anything else, if we can't find ways that they can make a living and make a life, as they say, then we're probably going to face even huger problems about migration and about conflict. But they have hope, and they give me hope that we can find a way to work our way through. So that's something about where my hope comes from. But there's some more underlying reasons why I have optimism. The reason is there are some theories about why there should be optimism. And there's a lot of research now. including formal experimentation that shows that that humans actually, through social psychology experiments and behavioural economics, humans show themselves to be social beings who can actually make altruistic decisions to give someone else the apple, as it were, rather than just take what's you know they could take. Now, of course, we all know that in making those decisions, we feel better about ourselves. We feel better through acts of kindness, compassion, and challenging hate. And I have to say, in my college, I was particularly... one thing I always do in graduation is to say to the women students who are going out that some of them will be senior leaders, and they have the capacity to make significant change in the world. Most of them will have some form of leadership at some level in their communities or in their work. But every single one of them can be a goddess of small kindnesses. So we all, you know, do actually get on by actually doing some of those things. We are beings that can act for the good of each other and for the good of the whole, and not just self-interest. Now, so self-interest and individualism lie within us, but equally it lies alongside community and solidarity. Our problem seems to be that in the Western world, we've sort of overdosed on individualism. But perhaps never before in human history have we been so clear that we're all in this together. I talked about jobs for young people. That's one of the big challenges. But there are many, many more, as hinted at before. We've got climate change. We've got the complete destruction of the environment, the species leaving. We have things like hate speech, misinformation, vilification. Some of this is, of course, engendered by extreme inequality in our society too, another major challenge, because rightly, many of those people feel very disenfranchised. So we've got some very big questions. Climate change is an obvious one where it cannot be solved just by individual action or even single countries, quite clearly. But the same pretty much applies to that list of the big challenges that we currently face. So it seemed to me that alongside things like kindness and respect, people who have an opportunity and the privilege to work on some of the bigger issues as they're seen, we also have a real responsibility to explain to people how interconnected, you know, we really all are. And I don't mean by that we sort of go global and forget the local, because it doesn't mean telling a person in this country who has just gone to the food bank or who's desperate for social care that they really should worry about the billion poor people who haven't got enough food in developing countries. As it happens, from my experience in Oxfam, they often do care about those people, but we have to respect what they are, you know, actually going through through here. But we should probably be ashamed that in this country, that in the financial crisis, we penalise the poorest people in the country the most, especially women, and we should get on and press for change there. So I think we need both kindness and respect and the power to explain our interconnectedness. And I guess quite a few people in this audience are what other people at least would label as elites, though we sometimes don't recognise it in ourselves that that's what we are. And I think what we have to do as well is to make sure we get out of our own bubble and listen and try to understand the experience of others. And it's a bit about curiosity, and it's a bit about imagination about other people's lives. And I have a little story from my college about the day after the Brexit referendum, because I called a meeting and said any students who wanted to turn up could come and talk about it, because it was sort of a big thing. And we talked about it for about 5 minutes, and then everybody realised we hadn't the faintest idea what was going to happen about Brexit, and so it turned out. But what the students really wanted to talk about was why they had so little understanding of what people in their own hometowns were feeling. There was one student there from a state school. She went to a state school in Wisbech, a town just north of Cambridge. And she said, I had no idea that people in my school even were so upset and angry about immigration and jobs. And I was very proud of those students, actually, that they were thinking that not, you know, just what had happened with the referendum, but were actually thinking, why is it we don't understand what the other is experiencing in this country? And there was quite a bit of work that then took place, actually, with an organisation called the Cambridge Commons, really. So I've talked about sort of a bit of individual action that we can do, but that clearly that's not enough for the big challenges that we're really facing. And I want in this next sort of big chunk I'm going to talk about is really to say that I think we need what has been called a new narrative, but also systems and organisations that can provide coherence so we can channel our hope into actual agency and really doing something. So on this narrative question, I've just read a book by somebody called Alex Evans, who'd worked around government here and at the UN, and it's called The Myth Gap. And what he says, which I rather took to, is that at the moment we're missing a narrative about where the world should go. And it's very easy, in fact, to work out why that should be the case. First of all, as people, we always get passionate about different things. They're things that actually affect either our personal lives or our working lives, our areas of work. Sometimes a common issue sort of rises to the top, like the NHS does in every election that I've ever known. You know, sort of there's an issue that grabs people, but mostly we're all thinking about different things that are happening. But also, as well as thinking about different things, we often find ourselves in surprisingly at odds with other people that you might expect to feel the same. For example, the Gilets Jaunes in France and the reaction to the carbon taxing of fuel is a prime example of that. I'm quite sure that there are lots of the Gilets Jaunes who are out there who were actually very concerned about climate change. But the fact that it was going to be taken out on them, the poor and squeezed middle people, did not go down at all well, for very understandable reasons. So even when people actually think some of the same things, you know, how they would then see what happened and the implications are really quite different. But it's not just about differences because of how we see things differently. It is, of course, about different power in the system. The people that have don't want to lose what they have. But those who do not certainly don't want the burden of the change to fall on their shoulders. And that's a prime example with the Gilets Jaunes. I mean, in all the work we were engaged in Oxfam, the most difficult thing to argue about was about redistribution. It's extremely difficult, whether it's about money or land, and we've seen that right across the world. There was, though, a wonderful period of hope, and I think it was about 10 years ago when it started, but there was a period when we could all say, congratulate Brazil and Mexico, that they were the two G20 countries who were actually managing to reduce extreme inequality. Fantastic. We thought people were on the move on that. Sadly, the impetus didn't really last, although the Brazilian Bolsa Família is still in existence, actually giving out money to families, and it's done a massive amount to deal with poverty in Brazil, although it's actually been reduced now. But a number of countries have taken that up. Ethiopia is now engaged in a new scheme like that. So people are arguing for change, but it is quite difficult. We have different views about things. We don't have this common narrative. And of course, the people who have the opposition to change, those who have, often have the power and influence to stop the change happening. And I just give one example of that. In the US, ExxonMobil actually lobbies Congress and the administration there to the tune of several billion dollars every year. It's all counted, it's there, to try and stop change that might influence their oil production. That's the sort of power that you have in systems. So you've got this sense of not all being together on what we want, but at the same time, the powerful having a very clear line about what they want to do, you know, really to stop change. And often, sadly, it's the extreme versions of that we hear the most about. It is quite easy to be extreme about these things rather than coming to a much more common agreement about what we might all want. And I was amused when I was in Oxfam. Once or twice I was on Any Questions and Question Time. But in each case, only once. And when my team asked why, not more, the answer came, because there had been very good feedback, actually, but the answer came was that I and Oxfam were not extreme enough. We weren't very interesting, because we just didn't say extreme things. Which is the absolute opposite of trying to get to a common narrative, because most people don't want those extremes. What they want is some common ground that we might all work on together. So I'm still cross about that, even years on. So can we ever get to a common story about what we want? And I think we can on some things. I mean, the threat of climate change is so severe. I do believe that eventually we will make progress. It's just the amount of suffering, particularly the suffering of the poorest people, that we will go along with until we really take action. But for many of the other issues I've talked about, immigration, young people, inequalities, we really don't have an accepted and agreed a narrative about a sense of where we want to go and these genuinely different interests. So I think we do have a big challenge in trying to build up a picture of the world that's something that we would all like to see and really gives enough, if you like, to everyone. But I do want to turn from the fact about the story to, well, do we have any mechanisms to try and, you know, churn, take our hope and turn it into real action? Because that's when, as I say, hope gives the agency to take place. And I want to talk about two particular ways, again, of my experience. One is actually campaigning, and the other one is about community organisation development. And on campaigning, just to start with where we are, on the big issues, the big global issues, we actually require governments to act, usually. We can sometimes get away with other people who take the place of government. And again, climate change in the US was very interesting. When we were all going into the big debates at Copenhagen in 2010, when some of us thought we might get there, the US, the government itself, was not in support and still isn't in support of climate change. But what did happen in the States, and which is still coming through now, is that in many states and cities, the leaders in those places took on the leadership and said, well, okay, we can't shift the US, but we can do our part in California or in this city. Even in a country where many people at that time didn't even believe that climate change was real. Another example, though, where I really do think we got to a common narrative and we really got action, was back in 2005 with Make Poverty History. There was a real moment in history where it felt like everybody around the world thought, yes, we can actually deal with extreme poverty. We can really do something about it. And at that time, of course, it was possible to come together across the world in the civil society sense of people coming together and showing to their governments what they wanted to make this happen. And that, I think, is one of the great things about what you do in campaigning. I was always amused in Make Poverty History because, if you like, the government at one point was sort of there, our government, and as aid agencies, we were saying, we want you over there. And we never expected them to get that far, and they didn't. But they got a lot further than they thought they were going to. And that's sort of quite often what campaigning agencies do. They set a target that is too far to get, but people can actually think that they might be able to move a bit towards it and make some difference. And that was really almost fun to watch, actually, just sort of seeing the movement. So it is possible through campaigning to get change, and I could give you other examples, but the Make Poverty one was a really fantastic example. And I think that people like, you know, Greta Thunberg and the Extinction Rebellion are in a sense pressing governments in a similar way now. Now, you may or may not agree with their tactics about what they're doing it, but they are certainly getting governments to look up and think, well, what is it that we really have to do? So there is campaigning, but it's jolly hard work. But I want to talk about community building. When I was in Oxfam, people often used to say to me, what is it that Oxfam really does? They knew about the water and sanitation or the, you know, sort of, I don't know, poor people in agriculture. But my answer was always the same thing. We help people organise themselves. That doesn't matter whether that's into producer organisations for farmers or marketing organisations or women's groups or getting local NGOs in one country to come together to lobby their own governments on health or education issues. What we did was not do it for them but try to help them organise so they could take action themselves. Now, of course, communities in developing countries are much more locally geographic communities than we are now, probably. But they can be very powerful. But I don't want to make communities sound perfect. Just to put the caveat in, they can be very tight-knit and with rather fixed ideas and include anybody who doesn't conform to them. So they're not perfect. But on the other hand, communities can be enormously effective in improving the lives of their own communities. And I saw that in lots of places, and I want to give two examples of where women's groups in particular were organised. And that's particularly important because in the community sense, women are often at the heart of community action. So in 2015, I was asked by WHO to lead a review of what happened with Ebola and how effective WHO was. And one of the key findings that came out of that was that where there were strong communities, that was such a determining feature of which of the countries actually managed to get control of Ebola first. So in Sierra Leone and in Liberia, women's groups and young people's groups in particular were very good at actually spreading the message, and they were trusted in their communities about what was to be done. Now in Guinea, which had had very, very little of that sort of development and certainly no women's empowerment, it took much, much longer to get the Ebola under control because people just didn't believe their governments and there was no local action. A wonderful Guinean social anthropologist said to me, "Ebola is a fire, and women are the water who put out the fire." That was a lovely statement, actually, about what was going on. But no women's groups there. Now, in Liberia, where we had been working a long time, the women's groups were really very well organised. We'd started work there probably in about 2005 in the capital, in Monrovia, working with women's groups on cholera, actually, trying to get them organised for looking after the where the water was and the sanitation and so on. And at the end of, when cholera was over, the women said, "Well, don't go away now. You know, we've just got organised. You know, we want to do something that will help our, you know, bring us some money in." So they, we sort of supported them in getting going with producing clothes as a cooperative. And they now do most of the school uniforms in Monrovia, actually. And I went to visit in 2008. And so they'd been going a bit by then. And so we came along and they said, "Right, we're going to tackle domestic violence in our community now. We've got organised. We're doing these other things. We're on to the next thing now." And lo and behold, when it came to 2015 and Ebola, there they were, really taking charge, really making things happen. Absolutely lovely. Now, the second example is when I visited a place on the outskirts of Lima in Peru. It's a district called San Juan de Lorigancho. And the people there were living in really very, very flaky, if you like, little huts, matting and boards, all on an absolutely barren hillside. They'd all been denuded there. And when the rains came, of course, all those houses, all those huts just went down the hillsides and so on. So we were spending time working with them, trying to get their housing on the safest parts. But we also worked with women on developing a community kitchen. That way, the women could go off into the city, Lima, and do sort of petty trading, little trading stuff every day. But they'd leave, you know, the families, the children, and the older people with a meal and in sort of good company, really. But again, once the women got together, they started becoming much more politically active. And it turned out the local mayor had been accused of corruption, and under the law, you're supposed to stand down when you're accused of corruption. And he hadn't. So that bunch of women went down and sat at the town hall and sat there until he resigned. Now, by working together, those women have become pretty formidable. In fact, I would say that the women there are the most formidable group of women I've ever met anywhere in the world. And it just shows how one thing leads to another and makes things possible. So these examples, to me, I'm trying to show you that really, that how much can be done with hope when communities can work together. So I think dealing with the challenges of the next decade, community action is a part of what's really vital, and it's fantastic to see that that's happening a great deal in the UK around, you know, issues around the environment and climate change. But I also think of those 600 million young people across the world who are not likely to have jobs. And they also depend on the community and on informal work within family and community to do that getting by thing. And the worry I have that if we're not very careful in those places, our Western individualist model will come in. And if we're not careful, actually break down those community strengths. And that is one thing we must not do to make their lives even harder. So to sum up, I'm just coming to the end of this. There are major global challenges. But I do believe that people have hope. And that gives us the agency to do things. And there's small things in some places and large in others. And you can't expect communities to solve the whole of climate change all by themselves. We need community action. We need to see the drive. But we also need to see something bind us together by way of putting our demands on government as well, potentially through campaigning. We've all got the possibility of doing things in our different roles, again, some large, some small. And I do believe that all of us have a human spirit in us that wants actually to do something that is altruistic, that does actually help the communities, all of our bigger communities really, grow and survive. And above all, as I've said, my hope comes from our young people, whether it's in this country or the ones I've seen internationally. I see their enthusiasm, I see their commitment, I see their desire to do something. But it's not our job to put the load on them. They certainly can't solve all our problems. But we can support their enthusiasm, we can support their ideas. And I do think, too, that if we could work together on the issue of climate change globally, which, as I say, I think we probably will ultimately have to do, as the most dramatic example of what's facing us, it may give us the spirit, the ability to work on some of the other major problems, really, and to get that wider narrative about the range of things that we have to tackle. I certainly hope we do, because if you think about the big challenges I've faced, it is actually a really very, very, very serious time in human history about what is going to happen. I'm hopeful we can do it. I think we can do it. But there's a lot of need for thinking about this, a lot of need for coming together in different ways so that we can actually work together to get the world we want in the end. Now, I hope that that gives you enough to think about, because it was a jolly difficult talk to think what to do with. And I'm sure you have your own views about what's possible and whether it's all going to work. So thank you.
Thank you so much. It's going to be your turn, but I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair to perhaps ask one or two questions, if I may, first. You started off with a very stark example of how we need hope in order to live, because the opposite of hope is despair, and despair is giving up, and that means giving up on life as well. So we've got hope, and we've got ambition, and we've got confidence, and we've got expectations, and I wonder where that comes from. Are we born with it? Is it something which is an expectation that we have in life, and is it something that we carry with us in whatever we do? How do we lose it? I would suggest, I don't know whether you would agree, that a constant frustration of expectation can lead to a kind of despair, therefore a loss of hope. Because if you constantly are told or learn or believe or experience a sort of loss of a rightful expectation as a human being. And I wonder whether we can translate that into a more modern context, today's context of politics. Is it the case that we now have had, or perhaps still have, probably still have, many communities around the country who have been so constantly frustrated in their quite rightful expectations of a decent life that they have given up hope, certainly in politics, and whether or not that is ever recoverable? Is there an inexhaustible supply of hope in people that they will immediately then start to hope when politics improves? I wonder, would you like to come to the podium and ask this? And then I will, I promise, go over to the audience.
Well, the first thing you made me think of really was, first of all, I'll come to the UK, but the first thing I thought of was actually the Arab Spring. Because you think about those young people that I'm talking about, what is happening to them is that they have expectations, a lot of them, particularly those who've had some education. You know, we've seen that. But what happens when that expectation isn't fulfilled, when they know that lots of other people are able to fulfill those things that they want? And then you do get that sense of a lack of hope. And, you know, the guy who actually committed suicide over not being able to just keep his, whatever it was, bread stall yes. going, is absolutely epitomises what you've just said about if you see things and you have expectation and then you run up against it and cannot get it, ultimately, you know, that hope does go. Coming over to the UK, though, I agree. I mean, in many ways, in many parts of the countries, we are a depressed society. In fact, you know, that hope has been depressed because often things have been suggested that things are going to get better, and they don't really. That is a problem with government. We know people actually really have so little trust in governments now. I don't know whether faith in them would ever come back eventually if they were really delivering. But I mean, the absolute key thing is to start delivering. And maybe a positive thing, not to be negative, is of course Scotland and what happened in Scotland. Fascinating that when in Scotland people went out from the Scottish government and talked to a lot of the people and asked them what it was they wanted most, which was mainly NHS health and social care, and then the government started doing more things for them. They not only liked it and expressed their like of it, they were actually willing to pay more taxes for it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not hopeless, but goodness me, it's a hard place to be now, isn't it, to get from here to the point where people have trust again in government.
Thank you. So it's over to you. Who would like to start? Yes, you're the brave lady here. Thank you.
Yes, what I'm going to say, as human beings, we all have hopes. And when you have hope and you keep trying, you keep hoping and it's not happening, people lose it. And sometimes people does commit suicide. So I don't know how we're going to work with it. And we might be Christians and God knows and he helps us. But when you're living in a community and getting support, that really helps us. And especially for today's, I'm going to say black kids, they are struggling. Is there a hope for them? And we have to pray for them very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Let's take one or two comments. And anyone else who would like to come up with a view? Yes, we have one here. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Rugi. I work with Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority, IPSA. I'm from Sierra Leone, and I've been following a lot of things happening in Sierra Leone. The youth's hope, the expectation, they've lost it. There are a lot of things happening in Sierra Leone now. No education, even when they say the government is giving free education, is so difficult. Now you can even see them sending messages, taking all types of drugs to feel when they are out of their senses is better. Because when they are in their senses, they don't see no hope of changes carrying on. People are using all sorts of drugs. And even latest, I'm not ashamed, our youths are boiling Pampers. That is what they eat. They can go off for 2 days, not feeling or knowing where they are. And this all our leaders know. The government knows. What hope do we have for our nation? We need help. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah. So the question, I'm going to go to you, Barbara, really becomes, how do we begin to generate it? You've talked about community organisation. The lady here said that community helps to keep hope alive, which I'm sure it does. But is there anything else that you can offer on that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, first of all, I do hope that this is truly a discussion, because I don't feel that I'm an expert in hope. I'm not serious about that. I mean, that we really have to grapple with this and really try and understand what we can do and where we can do it. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, first of all, let me deal with Sierra Leone. I mean, there are places and countries in the world where things are really, you wouldn't be surprised that people were feeling hopeless. And I'm back to we all have a responsibility about that. And we all have to try in whatever ways we can to do something about it. And in a funny way, I suppose when I was in Oxfam, I was most privileged to be able to do a little something, you know, tiny, tiny things. But I knew I was part of making some change to somebody somewhere. It's actually harder now I'm not in Oxfam, as it happens. When I see anything on the TV, I might see your Sierra Leone or whatever, you know, maybe, you know, in the Ebola time or something. Because I couldn't do anything, it was even harder, frankly. It is so you can feel better if you can do something to try to help, to try and make something better. But also mostly to try to actually give the power to the people there to do something better. And that's where the issue comes with the young people, I think. We've got to find ways that they can have enough to have the power to do something for themselves so that they feel better and that builds up again, because they don't want to be dependent. That in itself makes people feel you know, hopeless. And that's not, I think, so different from black young people, in British society too. I think that the difference maybe is in British society, actually a lot of our, for example, students in Cambridge, for example, are standing up and saying, look, we've had a pretty rotten deal of it and we're not going to put up with any more from you. And, you know, and actually are making their case very strongly. And that's right. It's sometimes hard to hear, but it's actually right that they are saying, you know, we have expectations and you ought to be able to deliver them from us, unlike in Sierra Leone, where it's really, really very difficult to do that. And by we, I mean actually the British people, the British government, it ought to be possible to actually give more, to make more possible for our young people, and particularly black young people who feel, you know, really aggrieved at the way they've been treated. And we just, the first thing to do is, though, to face up to that and understand what's going on. It's back to my thing about we've got to understand what other people are feeling, because that's what drives us then to do things or to be, take part in things that can make some difference, really. I'm not sure that's at all helpful to anybody, but it's, you know, at least thought-provoking, I hope.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you. My name is Shelley Maher. I'm from Magdalen College in Oxford. I'm very interested by your point that community building is vital for hope, and also your remark that women often play a vital role in that. My observation is that building communities involves tasks which are often not very tangible and aren't the sort of tasks that are commonly recognised and countered in many workplaces, at least in the Western world. The outcome, which is often long-term, is recognised, but the tasks it takes to get there aren't always tracked or celebrated. And I wonder if you would remark on what we can do as a society to support those who are building communities before their task is done.
Well, you're right. Actually, recognise it. But also, as you say, recognise the skills that it takes to do that. And I think that that's where, you know, my Oxfam experience comes in, though it was more international. But at least there, you could actually spend time working with the groups about how they could organise themselves, you know, how there could be leadership developed, how actually sometimes, you know, there was a need even for better financial literacy or something in order to be able to do some of the things. So, you know, I do think it's important that we think about that, because in this country, communities, there is a lot of community development going on in the UK. I run into lots of it. I run into lots of social innovation and so on. But it is hard work on the people concerned, both those sort of skill areas, but also just the time that people have to put in, the energy to persuade other people to join in, to do things. It is a big job, and we don't reward community. A parallel is we don't reward unpaid carers either. You know, they're not unlike each other in the sense that there's people doing a hell of a lot of work that isn't actually recognised by society. And maybe that's one of our big challenges, really, to think how we do that. I'm sorry, I'm going off the track a bit, but it's interesting with the carer side that here we have a society where we have gross inequality going on. And yet and jobs are going across the world in many, many ways because of, you know, robotics, etc. And what we have is many, many people needing care, whether they're children or older people and so on. And somehow we don't value the care. So we've somehow got, yet there's all this work to be done, but we're not actually valuing the work that does need to be done in society in any way, that particularly in any financial way, that people can therefore use to live on. And that seems another discontinuity in what we've got happening. But I completely agree with you. It's hard work doing community development, but at least in developing countries, when people get on with it, they see such rewards because it's making such a big difference.
I think if hope arises in part from achievement,
yeah,
and community organisation is to achieve something together for a particular community, which is essentially politics, then that is a way, yeah, of regenerating hope. Jamie, and then, yes, Jamie?
Jamie Hawking, I'm the canon theologian here. I wonder, you spoke a bit about skills that are needed in curating hope in society. I wonder if the other half of the skills equation is virtue. And in particular, if we're going to allow hope to flourish in a society, whether we need to pay attention to virtues such as truth-telling, justice, Why do I say that? Not because of any sort of narrow philosophical interest, but because I think those two realities, truth-telling and justice, unlock imagination. And actually, in a sense, finding a new way of having a public imagination, I think, is something which feeds hope. And I wonder if you have any reflections on that.
Let's get on to creativity, yes.
No, I think you're right. I think that's absolutely great. I keep coming with these things because I think that they're obviously, you know, from your thinking, that, I mean, absolutely right. And you're putting a very good point into that, I think.
I'm Anthony Ball, one of Jamie's colleagues here, not as effective a theologian. But I was wondering, perhaps building on this unlocking imagination, it felt to me your comments on individualism, the Western individualism, the community, that I think Evans is myth deficit, an overarching story vision for what we wanted the world to be. That's a kind of meta-narrative that we've become suspicious of overarching stories.
Yeah.
And the community work that you are describing seems to be lots of much smaller visions. And I just wonder whether building from the community vision, as it were, we might get to an overarching vision, or do you see that hope, that imagination needing a sort of great leadership that would unlock it? Or, I mean, that's the sort of tension there. But perhaps someone else at the back might add to it.
Do you want to take a couple together?
Yeah, all answers on a postcard are called for any of these.
You know. You are.
No.
Thank you.
Hello, it's Morwenna Carrington from the Department of Health and Social Care. One thing that nobody seems to have mentioned this evening is resilience. And I think, for me, it's unrealistic to expect people not to experience setbacks or you know, for people to experience adversity. But what stands out is people's ability to bounce back and to be resilient to those challenges. And that's where we get real hope. And I wondered what more we should be doing to encourage our children to be resilient and to go back to when they're very young and to build that in so that people are more innately resilient and able to withstand the challenges that they will face during their life.
Yeah. Shall I have a go at those? Well,
a few minor problems.
Yeah, a few minor problems, yeah. Interestingly about, do we get an overarching sort of theory out of the aggregation of community? I think that's sort of a bit of what you're saying. And there is a bit of evidence around that the environment movement seems to be sort of on, because they were saying that, you know, in the campaigning they've done, or we were doing sort of, you know, because the development agencies were working with the environment agencies sort of, you know, 2010 to 2012, 13. But they were coming to a recognition that unless you have a lot of community action that people are really engaged in, it doesn't add up to anything. So I think there is quite a lot of, if not the theory, at least the power comes from a lot of community action. I think I'd say that. But there are some meta-narratives. And there's a lovely one. There's a woman actually used to work with me in Oxfam, but she's now sort of an independent researcher. And one of the things that, it's a lovely description that she gives, for example, about society, and it's called donut economics. So if you think of a donut with two outside sides of what's going on, and her sort of statement of it is, we've got to get to a world where we don't breach all the environmental things, like too much CO2, you know, or whatever it is. We can't breach these environmental things. We've got to bring those back. And that's the earth. We have to live within that. That's the outside ring of the donut. But there's a sort of an inside ring. And basically, there are a lot of people who aren't even getting the basics, you know, health, education, all those things. And we've got to get the people out of that middle bit and into the donut. And we've got to figure out somehow a way to have an economics that where we don't consume so much and destroy so much that actually we can't help people out of that and in out of that middle bit and into the donut. And that really always struck me a very nice way to think about the whole economic framework that we have. It's a bit complicated to explain in a short bit, but it's sort of you know, everybody should have the minimum, which is really the sustainable development goals. But we've got to get them to that place without wrecking our whole global ability to survive. And that probably means that some of us have got to give up a certain amount. Ideally, not too much. You know, we can change it into you know, other ways of doing the same sort of things. But somehow we've got to get into that balance. And that's, it, if you like, one of the meta theories that I quite like. And the resilience. Oh, resilience is very difficult, isn't it? Honestly. It's on my mind a lot because at Cambridge, there's a whole discussion about why so many students are having so many such mental health problems, actually, and the discussion about resilience in that. And I agree with you. If we can find ways to help people have more resilience, but some of the pressures that are on our children, I don't just mean Cambridge, I mean children and young people, you know, in the UK, are very, very harsh now, actually. And, I think they do. Some of the social media stuff, for example, completely destroys resilience. You know, people who have an issue and then they are trying to get over that issue and yet it's rammed down their throats, or, you know, they are made foolish of or encouraged to feel that they are completely aggrieved in these circumstances. All those things are very hard now. So rather than just worrying about just the children, I think worrying about what's happening to them in society is just an equal thing to be about. But again, I wish we could find, you know, how to help people gain more resilience. I mean, I spend ages talking to my students about taking risks and not minding if you get it wrong, and not beating yourself up if it's wrong, but treating everything as a learning experience. Now, you know, in a way, that's a small way of trying to build resilience, allowing yourself to fail, actually.
I wonder whether any of you have seen or heard that YouTube clip, which is devastating, about the father in Idlib who is teaching his daughter to laugh when a bomb explodes. I mean, I don't know whether you would call that resilience, but, you know, the idea behind it is to protect that child from crippling fear. I found it really, really poignant is not the right word for it. Sorry, someone here and then here, yes. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Paul Twivey, and several years ago I did a project called Your Square Mile as part of the ill-fated Big Society, but well-intentioned Big Society. We went to 16 of the toughest communities anywhere in the UK, from ex-mining communities to Catholic and Protestant communities side by side in Northern Ireland to coastal towns. And they were some of the most deprived communities in Europe, not just the UK. And what I found very interesting about what gives hope, maybe somewhat unexpected, one of the first ingredients is anger, because this is about fight or flight. And so anger in Toxteth, for example, or some of the other areas that all they're stereotyped for is riots. So what they want to do is change that. The second is a sense of history, that even the toughest communities can change massively in 5, 10, 20 years, and giving them a sense of their own history and how that can change. The third thing is getting people together frequently, face-to-face, as we're doing now, and as big a diversity of them as possible, and seeing the prejudice they have about each other removed. I mean, one of many examples was a very punkish woman who nobody wanted to sit next to, who after 20 minutes said, "What I'm really worried about is the isolation of the elderly." And you could hear a pin drop, and I saw that time and time again. So people understanding the common humanity of people who look and feel very, very different. And devolution, genuine devolution of power, because we're overwhelmed with global problems, but we can't even get something done in our own streets. And so until we do that, until we restore power at the very simplest level, then we will not achieve anything. But those were some of the ingredients, and I have to say I found inspirational people who had hope when their children have been killed in gang warfare.
Did the power arise from organisation?
It arose from individuals and organisations, and it became
amplified. Coming together.
It became amplified when people who were very civically active and confident mixed deliberately, as we did, with people who'd never had any role in civic society at all. So, I hope that's useful. Those were some of the things that we learnt about hope in those communities.
We've got one. Let's take one here and then thank you.
Thank you. I'm Michael Peel. I'm an inner city GP in London. I have some concerns about resilience. I think that resilience actually is very closely allied with hope, because you can only really feel that you can cope with a problem if you've got that hope. And sometimes circumstances can be overwhelming and that resilience can't be there. And I think there's sometimes a danger when we talk about resilience that it can turn into blaming the victim. But I think the other point I was about to come to before the word resilience came up is about community and how that can help. Because in my business, in primary care now, social prescribing is an important concept. Yeah. I don't like the term because it implies that you need a piece of paper from your GP to get involved with a local community group. But I think in a lot of places there are community groups being set up. I'd have to say a lot of the time they're getting set up despite the system rather than because of it. And I think that some fairly small scale efforts of pump priming would really make a big difference. The sort of things that have worked when I was working in Africa, actually we can import back here again and look at how fairly minor things, but helping people come together to produce projects can make a great deal of difference. And I think there is an awful lot of will out there. And I think it's really trying to focus that will to create something positive.
Thank you.
Barbara.
Well, I think that's very helpful, your last point, because, I mean, in a sense of a positive of what you can do, it made me realise again how much community we have lost in the UK. I was thinking, for example, about, the whole issue about knife crime and that there are no youth clubs for anybody to go to. They're all about community again, actually. That's people meeting together. That's people thinking that they can do something together. They can find a way to do things. And because we seem to have got to a point where we don't think that's important. And the money was taken out of that sort of thing, because it isn't that actually people living in societies and having other people to generate ideas with and do things with isn't important somehow. And you're sitting obviously in the place as a GP of seeing, yes, it is important, and you're having to even prescribe it, which is fascinating, isn't it, really? That what people do naturally in forming communities, you're having to at least persuade your people to go along and join those. Whereas it ought to be part of what we're doing. But that's good stuff, isn't it? I mean, that's absolutely right, that people can get, more hope that. And I was interested also in the blame the victim issue on resilience, because we do have to be... Actually, students in Cambridge won't use the word resilience. They do think it means blaming the victim. That's what they think that's about, actually. Now, others of us might have thought that... It's funny, actually, because schools now teach resilience, and there's whole programmes about resilience going on in schools, and then they come to us, and then we say resilience, and they say, no, you're blaming the victims again, And we have to be so careful. I mean, some of that's a bit about words, actually, but we do have to be careful not to think that some of the things that people are going through really are pretty awful in the world, and think before we expect them to be resilient that we may have to put something back in, to help them take those first steps back, because actually somebody has noticed the depth of their inability now to move and can offer something, and sometimes it can be physical, it can, in the sense of, even some money to be able to do something or whatever it is, but somehow or other something comes in that gives you the hope to pick up from that state that you're in and use that resilience to move on. I'm sure, for instance, in the people whose houses are flooded recently, if they felt that, for instance, somebody was actually giving them several thousand pounds immediately to start putting their houses right, they would feel more hopeful.
Yeah.
They would use that money to get on and say, I can get started, I can do something. That's what I mean by, that sometimes we have to bring something in to allow people to get to that point of resilience, really.
As I understand it, in Scotland, when they were tackling knife crime, that they approached it with a public health approach, which means that they employed the church and the youth clubs and the schools and the National Health Service outlets, all of them together, to actually look at knife crime, and they were remarkably successful. So again, that's a question of the community coming together in order to tackle one of community's major problems. And it is possible. But
we want support to go with communities. I mean, what it feels like in the UK often is that it's almost that community sort of isn't there. And then there are some people who are trying to build some community. And as we said, the woman at the back said, it's sort of left to them to try and do it and do all that hard work to make it happen. There isn't a lot of support going into how you can help communities thrive in their different ways, whatever, you know, age group you're dealing with, or whether it's loneliness in old people or your knife crime in young people or whatever it is. There's not a lot of support coming in to allow people that bit of energy and effort, because they're putting loads of effort in, but they have to do it in a really hard way.
Oh dear, this is our first foray into hope. I hope that's not too negative. Well, we've got some positive things out of this.
Yeah,
we've got community.
But we can persuade people to try and do this.
And confidence and achievement.
Yeah.
So, you know, go back to your communities and organise, is I should say. Barbara, thank you so much for a really, really sort of mind-stimulating talk and discussion thereafter. Thank you all very much, and thank you, Barbara.